Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're talking about bioethics with Wesley Smith this evening. Our conversation continues with your phone calls as well. We've stepped one foot into the brave new world. Perhaps you might say we could see it there on the horizon. We are certainly in the prelude to this brave new world. What do we do with these technologies? And in this hour, as time permits, we got to talk about a few of the ideas behind these technologies and behind the debate, stem cell debate, cloning debate. And are these things even workable if you try and work out the numbers? Wesley's alluded to a couple of those things in the last hour, and we'll get to all of those, including your phone calls at 1-800-730-2727. If you're getting a busy signal, keep trying. We're going to be freeing up phone lines here in less than a minute. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Issuesetc@kfuo.org. Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's go to St. Louis and talk with Greg. Greg, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I have a question about the ethics of stem cell research being done, say, with a blood sample drawn from the umbilical cord of the mother at birth. And I may be wrong here, but it seems to me to almost completely sidestep the issues. There's no risk to the mother or to the baby. And I'm just wondering how that fits into the equation ethically.
Well, Greg, thank you very much for the call. Wesley, when our kids were born, we donated, I signed a form. It said, donate umbilical umbilical cord blood. And this was 10 years ago. They were looking for stem cells in the cord blood.
Right. No, I know of no ethical or moral objections to that. This is the afterbirth. It is apparently a treasure trove of potential healing medical cells with medical properties. And to show you how it's not controversial, the divide that the cloning divide, you've had Dianne Feinstein, who is my senator, Orrin Hatch, and John Kerry saying we should legalize therapeutic cloning. On the other side, you've had Sam Brownback saying we should outlaw all human cloning. Those senators have come together to support a national umbilical cord blood stem cell bank. It is non-controversial. I think we should all support it. Umbilical cord blood stem cells have already cured people with sickle cell anemia, and they're beginning to use it in research of other kind of neurological diseases. So this is a real potential cornucopia of healing and palliation of suffering for the world.
And just so people are clear here, this is umbilical cord blood that is drawn after the child is born,
right,
after the placenta is delivered, after the placenta and the umbilical cord are completely separate from mom and baby.
Right, it's the afterbirth. The afterbirth, it turns out, isn't something to be thrown out. It's something to be really used for human good.
Greg, call back. I would like very much to send you a copy of this book, A Brave Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, by our guest, Wesley Smith. Laura's up next, calling from St. Louis. Laura, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you very much. I have a question on the cloning portion of your discussion.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I was wondering how useful an egg is even after the nucleus has been removed, because isn't it true that the egg cell still contains mitochondria that contains the egg donor's DNA?
That's a very good question, Laura. This has to do with some of the topics that you also talk about in your book, the trying to cross the line between
animals and humans.
Yeah, animals and humans.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, in the somatic cell nuclear transfer, and let me go over it again real quickly for people who might have just tuned in. Cloning, which is also called somatic cell nuclear transfer, you take an egg and you take out the nucleus. And if you're going to clone me, you take one of my skin cells, we'll say, and take out the nucleus, and you put the skin cell nucleus into where the egg nucleus used to be. You now have a genetically modified egg that has full 46 chromosomes. Then it's zapped with electricity. Now, this is easy to describe but hard to accomplish. And if it works, you then have a new human organism, which is almost an identical twin of me. And the reason I say almost is the very point that Laura brought up. The egg also has DNA. It doesn't have chromosomes, but it has mitochondrial DNA. It's about 1 to 2% of the DNA now in that new human organism would consist of the DNA from the egg. Now, that comes into two questions. Number one, in therapeutic cloning, if you're going to use tissues taken from that embryo or if we gestated into a fetus, which I'd like to get into because that is what they're talking about doing and passing laws to permit, which is gestating cloned embryos into the fetal stages, would that be rejected because of the mitochondrial DNA? Don't know. There have been some animal studies where there has been rejection, and there have been some animal studies where there has not been rejection. But here's another problem. One of the issues, and it's a huge issue in this because it demonstrates how impractical the idea of therapeutic cloning is to make what Ron Reagan at the Democratic Convention said is that we'll each have our own repair kits at the hospital. And by that he meant we'd each be able to have cloned embryos at the hospital waiting for us to be able to harvest for tissues if we have problems like with Parkinson's or heart disease or whatever. Now that means you're going to have hundreds of millions, literally, of cloned embryos on ice. Well, that would require, as you just heard, hundreds of millions of eggs if it was just one egg per patient. But guess what? There's a very important article published in the National Academy of Sciences, actually, called Therapeutic Cloning in the Mouse. And this is reported at 100 Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences, September 30th, 2003. This is a pro-cloning researcher named Peter Momberts who's been doing therapeutic cloning experiments with mice. And he is very discouraged. And he has said that one of the problems is the efficiency of getting embryonic stem cell lines from cloned embryos is horrible and is not improving in mammals, much less in humans, which has only been done once. He estimates it's going to take 100 eggs per patient in terms of cloning to get one usable embryonic stem cell line, even if that could be done. 100 eggs. Now, the National Academy of Sciences has said 100 million Americans could benefit from regenerative medical therapies. That would be 10 billion eggs. Guess what, Todd? There aren't that many eggs ever going to be around. But even if we decided to only treat the 100,000 most sick people with therapeutic cloning, that's still 10 million eggs. Where are you going to get all those eggs? The way you get eggs from a woman is a very onerous and difficult procedure. It's called superovulation or hyperovulation. What you do is you give her strong hormones so that instead of releasing one egg in a cycle, she releases 10 to 20 eggs. That's very hard on the body. It can have serious side effects. About 1 in 100 women end up with swollen ovaries up to the size of a grapefruit. Some become sterile. A few die. There are infections. All kinds of things can happen. So you're not going to have a lot of women lining up, at least certainly not the kind of number and the kind of numbers you would need for therapeutic cloning to work. So what they're going to probably end up doing is going to poor world, the poor women of the world, like in Kenya or Bangladesh, and paying them a little bit of money to get their eggs, which is then using women as egg farms and treating them as commodities. Because you know what? In those poor countries, there wouldn't be the medical treatment necessary to help them when and if side effects occurred. That is why people like Judy Nurseegian, who wrote Our Bodies Ourselves, she's about as feminist a feminist as you get, opposes cloning because she sees it as an issue of the exploitation of women. Now, how do we get out of that problem with there are not going to be enough eggs? One suggestion is animal eggs, that if you take the nucleus out of the animal egg and put in the human nucleus and zap it, you can get an embryo. It would be a hybrid embryo. It would be part animal and mostly human. That's already been done in China with rabbit eggs. Now, in terms of therapeutic cloning, as Laura pointed out, oh my gosh, now you're putting animal DNA into people. What would that do to people? Would that be safe? Would that cause rejection? You know, these are issues that would take years and years to sort through, not to mention the moral problems of creating human-animal hybrids. There's another way potentially out of the egg dearth. that I've just discussed. And it's horrible. And that is to use aborted fetuses, because all of the eggs a woman ever has were basically built or came into being in her body while she was a fetus. At approximately 6 months, she has all the eggs she's ever going to have. And already in the Netherlands and in Israel, they are trying to find aborted female fetuses, taking the ovaries, trying to extract the eggs and learn how to mature them, because you need to mature them for the egg to be usable in terms of cloning or in vitro fertilization, and these experiments are to support in vitro fertilization. But if we're going to start looking to aborted fetuses for a source of eggs, then you're going to have abortions at a relatively late stage, midterm or late stage. And now we're talking about abortions that would keep the ovaries intact, and that could be partial birth abortion.
So it sounds as though, folks, I want you to just see the scope of this. Regardless of what path lies before us into this brave new world, even on the simple question of where are the eggs going to come from for human cloning, there are no good avenues open. None of the quote-unquote solutions being offered here are solutions that people can live with. They're all going to require the death of someone, and that's the basic bottom line that we're talking about here, and dangers to those who try to partake in these technologies. When we come back, more with Wesley Smith and your phone calls after this.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
Issues Etc. is looking for one member from each Lutheran Church Missouri Synod congregation to become our official lay representative. Responsibilities simply involve promotion of Issues Etc. in your local church. Now, if you're interested, leave your name, phone number, and mailing address, and your congregation's name, city and state, on our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172, or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Exploring the brave new world of bioethics with Wesley Smith. Wesley is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. You can find out more about this book on the web at WesleyJSmith.com. That's WesleyJSmith.com. We have two open phone lines for your questions and your comments. The others are full, but the two of them are open. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or feel free to use our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Charles is up next. He's calling from Kansas City. Thank you for your patience, Charles, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, how you guys doing tonight?
Very well.
Well, after listening to you, I have a couple of questions now. The first one I had that I called in about is, I know it sounds kind of crude, but I believe that their ultimate idea is to use human cloning for farming human beings for parts.
All right, let me answer that, and then we'll go to the second one.
Sure.
He's just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not really after you. What we have already seen in animal experiments is precisely the kind of worry that the caller, it's Charles, right?
Yes.
That Charles is talking about. There has been an experiment done a couple of times, and the most notable was from Advanced Cell Technology, which is a company out of Worcester, Massachusetts. What they did is they created a cow embryo using the somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning technique I described. They implanted it into a cow's womb. They gestated that embryo, that cloned embryo, to the early fetal stage, aborted the fetus, procured the kidneys, and then grafted those primordial kidneys onto the cow whose DNA was used in the somatic cell nuclear transfer. They found that those kidneys did not reject and indeed produced urine. This was touted in the media as proving that therapeutic cloning would work. Now, in order to do that in a human, what you'd have to do is create a human embryo through somatic cell nuclear transfer, implant it into a woman or an artificial womb, and realize, Todd, that in about 10 years we're going to have artificial wombs. Gestate that to about the time when the kidneys could be usable, abort that fetus, and then transplant those kidneys into the donor that provided the DNA. And today in New Jersey, that kind of abhorrent experiment would be legal, because New Jersey, and this shows you the agenda of big biotech and the researchers, that they're not going to limit themselves to embryonic stem cells. New Jersey has legalized cloning, has allowed women to be implanted, and they did that by not making it illegal. So a woman that it's not, if it's not illegal to implant a cloned embryo into a woman, by definition it's legal. And allowed the gestation of these cloned embryos through the ninth month, only requiring that that clone child be killed, literally, at the point or before it becomes born. This is one of the most radical laws ever created, because it has established a specific category of human beings, not that which can be killed, but which must be killed. It also opens the door for the very kind of organ farming that Charles is worried about, and we've already seen the animal research where this is being done. Now, the biotechnologists were up and down. They have no intention of doing this. But the experiments belie their assurances, plus these laws that are being put into place in New Jersey and proposals in Illinois and Delaware and other places, Texas, to allow gestation of cloned embryos through the ninth month, says that something is afoot. And some other uses of these cloned gestated fetuses would be to use them in drug testing instead of animals, to create specific disease models for experimenting and so forth. So we are talking about creating human lives for the purpose of experimenting on them and destroying them and not bringing them to birth. And that is about as radical a notion as anything I've ever heard of.
Your second question, Charles.
Oh, yes. Listening to you talking about the eggs and where they could get them from, do you think it's possible that they might start getting the ovaries from cadavers, from people donating them when they die?
Charles, thank you very much. Wesley, you mentioned getting them from aborted fetuses, and there we're certainly dealing with the cadavers. What about people donating them? A woman dies in a car crash, she donates her ovaries, and there's a source of eggs, they say.
Well, that would not be objectionable in the sense of these other forms, because I certainly don't object to organ transplantation. I would object to using the eggs for cloning, but you'd have to also mature those eggs. And I don't think that the number of eggs obtainable in that fashion would be enough to provide the total supply, but that would be one I actually, frankly, hadn't thought about, a potential way around it that might be a little bit less morally problematic.
1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We've got a few more minutes here before we take our bottom of the hour break. Let's talk with Janine in Camdenton, Missouri. Janine, welcome.
Hi. I also have two questions. Let me give you my first one. Besides the tumors that you mentioned earlier, has embryonic stem cell research produced any positive results in all the years it's been done? And if we're using our own cells for, let me get it right, somatic cell nuclear transfer,
yes,
and there's already a disease or condition that has a genetic base present, wouldn't that carry over too?
Two very good questions. Let's deal with the first one. Any positive result from embryonic stem cell research?
Very minor. They're still unable to create specific tissues that they're, let's say they wanted a neural tissue. They can't just take a stem cell and turn it into a neural tissue. What they're finding is they're being able to turn them into all kinds of different tissues in the dish. There have been no human applications at all for embryonic stem cells. There have been applications in animals with very mild success on Parkinson's, but 20% of the mice who had very mild success with Parkinson's died of brain tumors from these embryonic stem cells. So the successes have been extremely mild to date.
Janine, second question. And I guess the scenario is this.
Yes, if you create a clone, let's say it's you have a genetic situation, a juvenile diabetes, which is where the autoimmune system attacks your body to cause the juvenile diabetes. If you're using the same genetic makeup, there may be a quick reversion to the problem that you're trying to cure. Now, what some biotechnologists are saying is, well, maybe we can do genetic engineering of the clone tissues and then overcome that. It's interesting, that, though, that juvenile diabetes has been cured in mice using spleen cells, because the spleen cells moved over into the pancreatic cells in these mice and created islet cells so that the insulin could be made. Whether or not that would be a permanent cure, or whether that would be like turn it into a chronic condition, I'm not sure. But the problem with the reoccurrence of genetic problems is an issue in regenerative medicine, both for embryonic and adult stem cell issues.
With less than a minute, look, Dolly the sheep was technically, when she was born, when she was old. She was
Dolly
6 years old, because the genes that were used to clone her were from a six-year-old sheep, and I'm wondering if that also presents problems in all of this.
Sure. Cloning, you know, I heard one biotechnologist told me it's kind of like putting Humpty Dumpty together again, because you're taking two broken cells, you're putting them together and expecting to have a good result. That's almost impossible when you think about it. And so we find that cloning has imprint problems, that is, genetic misapplications very early on in development. We still don't know whether cloned embryonic stem cells would have chromosomal abnormalities or genetic problems.
30 seconds, sir.
We do know that all animals, that there are terrible birth defects in cloned mammals, that one-third of cows, for example, have died who were the birth mothers of clones because of gigantic placentas. There are all kinds of problems with cloning that would take a long time to work out, and yet this adult stem cell therapies and umbilical cord blood stem cells are moving forward at a breathtaking pace.
Wesley Smith is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk more about bioethics, and we'll take your phone calls on the other side. The basic challenges of raising small children may be simple, but that doesn't mean they're easy. In the Christian home, how do we teach our small children about sin and about their Savior Jesus Christ? How do we guide them in their daily life as a baptized child of God, the life of daily repentance and the forgiveness of sins in Christ? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for November is called Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers. Or, if your children are older, we're offering Faithfully Parenting Teens. You can order either of these books for $9.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Preschoolers or Faithfully Parenting Teens.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Faithfully Parenting Teens, Pastor John Buca. Pastor Buca, what do you mean by faithfully parenting?
Parenting so often is really dealt with. You deal with as parents' successes and failures, and more often than not, as a parent, you realize that failures are part of what it means to be a human being. Rather than being successful, the more important task here is to be faithful to God's call, to be a faithful parent, to raise your child up in the way that God wants you to raise him or her up. And then on top of that, faithfully parenting means that I'm going to make a commitment as a parent to be home in the village. The African proverb says it takes a village to raise a child, but there's nobody home in the village more often than not. And we as parents, and we as church educators, and we as pastors and parishioners need to be home in that village for our children. That's why we need to be faithful to that task.
So what are the unique challenges facing parents today?
I think the unique challenge for a parent is to make sure that they continue to give their child the gift of their presence, not TS, but SENCES. And by that, I mean that the greatest temptation for me as a parent is to believe that my child needs more programs, from soccer to basketball to golf to dance to hockey to Boy Scouts to Girl Scouts. I can overly program my child from morning to night. In fact, I believe we're raising overly committed kids. The theological faith problem with that, however, is that to teach our kids to be committed to everything is to allow them to forget about the only commitment that's important, and that's their commitment to God and the faith that God has given them. Therefore, I think that's the greatest challenge. And also the secondary challenge is to believe that I can do this parenting on my own. I don't need God's help, nor do I need anybody else's help. And that I'm embarrassed if I confess that I don't know everything. You know, it's a self-sufficient, self-reliant world in which we live. That runs contrary to our Christian faith. We're called to rely on Jesus. We're called to rely on the community of believers. And we're all in this together as baptized Christians.
Order Faithfully Parenting Teens by calling 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor, when in fact what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about bioethics. Wesley Smith is our guest, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, or call in number 1-800-730-2727. Tim's been very patient, waiting in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Tim, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi. I've got a couple of questions as well. I don't even know what is an embryo a human?
Well, biologically, an embryo is definitely a human. It is a human organism. You were a human when you were an embryo, just as you are today. Again, whether that matters in terms of morals or ethics is not a science issue. It is a moral and ethical issue that needs to be debated. But scientifically, it is human.
Okay. But what is a stem cell then? What's the difference between a stem cell and an embryo and an adult?
That's a good question, because a lot of times there's a lot of junk science being pushed by the biotech community, and even in some of the most prestigious medical journals, such as the New England Journal of Medicine, that acts as if a stem cell and an embryo are synonymous when they're not. A stem cell coming from an embryo is a bit of is a cell within the embryo itself. So in order to get embryonic stem cells, you destroy the embryo, take the 100 to 200 cells inside at the time that this is done, which is 1 week after the creation of the embryo, and then derive the stem cells. So what you're taking in embryonic stem cell research are bits and pieces of the body of the embryo.
But it requires the entire destruction.
Yeah,
of the
whole embryo gets destroyed. There are also, as we've talked about earlier, stem cells found in human blood, human bone marrow, human fat, which means I'm a cornucopia of stem cells, human brain, umbilical cord blood, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. This is the confusion that I think often occurs here, because there are all these terms floating around. And as you mentioned in the first hour that we talked, the popular press and many times even the peer-reviewed journals from time to time don't seem to be taking a lot of care to properly define these things, distinguish these things, or clear up any of the confusion. In fact, they seem, through the use of euphemisms, lots of gobbledygook technical jargon, and downright misleading statements, they seem to be trying to maintain some level of confusion on all these things.
Well, yeah, and that's in large part that's because that's what the science community is trying to do. Science has become incredibly politicized. A lot of people think now of just science as objective ways of determining knowledge, and of course that's what science should be, you know, with testability, repeatability, and so forth, the scientific method. But if you take a look at what's going on in science today, it has become a political movement. It has, in fact, I have a lot of quotes in Consumer's Guide of high mucky muck scientists talking about how they're a special clan and they have a special way of looking at the world. And you find tremendous attempts to, because we are in a political debate about these issues, a moral and ethical debate, tremendous attempts to fool people. For example, Tim's call. Some scientists have said, well, you know, it's not an embryo isn't really human. A fellow at Advanced Cell Technology, Michael West, said it's not human until the 14th day when the primitive streak starts to appear, which is the beginning of the creation of the brain and spinal cord. But that's junk science. If you take, I went to embryology textbooks, which don't have a political iron in this, to check this out. And the embryology textbooks I read, and more than one, it is a new, distinct human life from the moment of conception, and we would have to say from the moment of inception with regard to cloning. So there is tremendous obfuscation and disingenuous advocacy. And what happens with the media is they'll come to somebody like me, and I might say what I just said to you. Then they'll call a scientist, and he'll say, oh, well, you know, I'm the scientist. That's not a human life. Well, the media person is probably not a scientist. They'll say, well, the scientist must know. But what the scientists are doing is corrupting science in order to win this ethical and moral debate. And it's kind of reminds me of the old statement from Vietnam days. I'm old enough to remember, you know, we destroyed the village in order to save it. And there are many now in the science establishment who are beginning to worry that science, in order to win these debates, is debasing what science is supposed to be.
One of the things that concerns me the most, and you include this in a chapter called Political Science in your book, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, is the editorial process at peer-reviewed scientific journals. And at least in one case, you have cited where one of these peer-reviewed journals, the editorial board has said, look, we have an agenda. And we're going to choose articles that will further this agenda.
The New England Journal of Medicine issued an incredible editorial. I mean, it's really appalling. They said that it is unreasonable to block therapeutic cloning. Now, editorially, they have a right to take that position, just as I have a right to say we should block therapeutic cloning. That doesn't bother me. But what bothered me was that they then said that in order to promote the research, they were going to select articles explicitly for that purpose in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, what does that mean? That means that they have said that in addition to the quality of the science to go in this prestigious journal, they're going to be looking at the political impact of the report. That is corrupting the job of the New England Journal of Medicine, which is to report on objective science. And, of course, they have every right to have a political and ethical position in their editorials. But that should not cross over into the articles, the science articles they decide to publish. So what if a report came to them, or a study in which somebody concluded that the tumor problem in embryonic stem cells was probably intractable? Would they publish it? because that goes against what they said they want. They want to publish articles that promote their political perspective. This is a corruption of the science process that I was describing, and that's just one example.
What is scientism?
Scientism is it's almost a quasi-religion that sees science as the salvation of humankind, that looks to immortality, for example, or the idea that only scientists can know what is moral in science, and because science is so important to the human condition that we have to take lay people out of it and the scientists should be able to decide for themselves. In essence, it almost supports a Scientocracy. It's very concerning because if you take a look at the old eugenics movement, that was scientism in action, where there was this belief that we could improve the gene pool in the human condition by keeping certain people from procreating, and that led to 60,000 to 70,000 involuntary sterilizations in this country between 1908 and the early 1960s. It was steeped in scientism, that science was going to save humankind from the depredations of so-called unfit people. And you see this again now in this whole idea of biotechnology. One of the greatest examples is that transhumanism movement that I talked about in the first hour. Transhumanism wants to create a post-human species through genetic engineering and cloning. They want to mix animal and human DNA. They want to create enhanced people for intelligence, enhanced people for athletic skills. They want to be able to put hawks' DNA into us so we could have better eyesight. And they're seeking, literally, immortality. Immortality. They have their own eschatology that somehow there'll be this critical mass when we will break out of the human limitations that somehow nature has inflicted upon us, and we'll be able to download ourselves into computers, and we'll be able to have clones to have repeated lives. I mean, it's just crazy stuff that almost surely will never happen. But the value system that this promotes is a super race theory. It is a eugenic theory, and it is really inimical to the continuing of the sanctity of life ethic. Do you know, Todd, that right now we are wiping Down syndrome people off the face of the earth through selective abortion and embryo selection? We are deciding that some people have greater value than others. You know, Down syndrome people, as far as I'm concerned, are some of the best humans who ever lived. They're sweet, generally. They're kind. They're loving. They want to be efficient and do their share. And yet we're told that because they've got mental retardation that they're less valuable than the rest of us. Well, what a crock.
Wesley, there's also an ethic at work here that has kind of become the creed of scientism, usually called utilitarianism, known more popularly by the little phrase, the end justifies the means. With 2 minutes, tell us about it.
Exactly. Utilitarianism, generally stated, is a philosophy that says that which reduces suffering or increases happiness should be promoted. That which causes unhappiness or increases suffering should be prevented. And that sounds good on a general sense, but what if you're an individual deemed to cause human suffering or reduce the amount of happiness? That means you can be killed. Peter Singer, who is one of the chief proponents in the world today out of Princeton University of this utilitarian ethic, uses that approach to say that parents should be able to kill their newborn infants if the newborn infants are going to make the family unhappy. He's world famous for this, and because of his promotion of animal liberation and infanticide, he's now at perhaps the most prestigious chair in bioethics at Princeton University. And some of the quotes I put in Consumer's Guide, there are a lot of scientists who accept this utilitarian mindset. And that's why we are in a crucial moral and ethical debate, whether the sanctity, equality of life ethic will guide our decisions on what is moral and not moral in science, or whether a crass utilitarianism and this philosophy of scientism will guide us. And if that is what occurs, I suggest, and I believe quite strongly, that science will not so much serve society anymore as dominate it.
Wesley Smith is our guest when we come back. What should we say yes to? What should we say no to? We'll answer those questions after this.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Ten more minutes left in our conversation with Wesley Smith on bioethics. We've got a long way to go, though. Wesley, the last part of your book, I thought probably for those who are reading of these issues for the first time, and finally after being bombarded with all of the facts and the issues that are face us in this brave new world, what they really need is, okay, a basic guide, as you've tried to put together here, of what we should pursue and what we should say here at the early stages. No, let's go no farther, let's fund it no more, let's make it illegal. Let's start with what we should say yes to.
Well, we should say for sure yes to adult stem cell research, genetic umbilical cord blood stem cell research, and those kinds of regenerative medical treatments where in our own bodies or non-morally problematical sources of stem cells can be used as very potent medicine. And this is very exciting stuff that may, within 5 to 10 years, really be providing tremendous succor and relief for people. Secondly, I think we need to certainly say yes to a federally funded umbilical cord blood cell bank that would fund the storage of these umbilical cord blood stem cell storage. Very important stuff. There's a fellow who's a friend of mine in Stanford University. He's on the President's Council of Bioethics. He is trying to come up with a way to get embryonic stem cells, but without using an embryo. And if he can come up with a way to do that without creating a human organism, which he's calling a clonal artifact, if that could actually be done, then that would be fine also. But we have to really be clear. We are not against research. We believe in scientific progress. We believe in palliating pain. We believe in treating disease. You know, the people who oppose me and the people I work with and my side of this debate say that we believe people should suffer because that God wants people to suffer. And that's just a two-dimensional caricature that is really beneath contempt. But there are things we should say no to also, because there are moral avenues that we should not go down because they lead off an ethical cliff. You know, what Mengele did in the concentration camps, from a purely scientific standpoint, was interesting, but it was a moral abomination. We don't just do something because it is scientifically interesting. We also have to mitigate science, which is amoral after all, with proper morals and ethics, and we must pursue this based on the sanctity and equality of life ethic. That is what the Nuremberg Code was all about. So what should we say no to? We should say no to human cloning. And we really didn't even get to scratch the surface as to all the reasons why. But that's really important, because without human cloning, there'll be no genetic engineering. Without human cloning, there'll be no fetal farming for organs. Without human cloning, there will be no transhumanism and so forth. Secondly, we should say no to putting animal DNA and things of that sort into human embryos, which are being contemplated. We should make sure that we do not exploit human life in any regard as commodities. And there are some things we have to talk more about, too. For example, if you take a human gene and put it into a cow, in its milk you may be able to produce great medical substances. This is called farming, P-H-A-R-M-I-N-G. I'm not against that because the locus of human dignity is not in a gene. So if you could, or you could do this in plants, if you could grow tobacco from which they could get medical substances, I'm all for it. But we have to decide how much is too much. There was, you talk about scientism, there was a fellow at Stanford who has suggested they could make a mouse with a human brain. Now, there are some things we shouldn't do because you reach a point where you are crossing human and animal species and in which you are really denigrating human dignity. Todd, there is no more important question than whether life has ultimate intrinsic value simply and merely because it is human. If we answer yes to that question and then pursue these agendas based on that, we'll be okay. If we answer no to that question and say being human is really not what gives us moral value, then we're going to be able to justify the most crass, utilitarian, and immoral types of research because if we think something is going to give us a payoff, you talked about the ends justifying the means, then that's where we'll head, and we'll fall off an ethical cliff. It's happened in society before. Every time we answer no to the question I posed, we end up in a ditch.
There's one other thing that you say we ought to say no to, and it really kind of draws it all together when it comes to, well, we had a call earlier, Grace, who was saying, well, you know, if we got the baby in a Petri dish, then we're dealing with a different situation than a child implanted in the womb.
We should say no to implanting embryos in a womb, whether real or artificial, for any purpose other than bringing that child to birth.
Talk a bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, it's very important because right now, as I said, there are laws, there's a law in effect in New Jersey and legislation that would permit gestation of cloned embryos way beyond the embryonic stage and perhaps even fetuses that were created through fertilization, not to be brought to birth, but for use as research subjects, sources of organs, and so forth. And with artificial wombs, and when you think about Grace, who I know and love, she said unless it's in the mother, it's not really human. But what if they took an embryo and put it into an artificial womb, which will be online in 10 years, and decided to gestate that embryo in the artificial womb to 3 or 4 or 5 months when it's a fetus, would it still not be human? And that is something that may be happening. And then what the biotechnologist would say was, look at all these cures we're going to be able to get, or look at the drug testing we're going to be able to do without using animals. And since these are in artificial wombs and can never actually be born, we're not doing anything wrong. And because once you say we can use one form of human life as an instrumentality, how are you going to have a firm and fast stopping point? You're not. Let me give you, if I have a moment, to give you an example of this. I was on television about a year and a half ago in Canada, and we were having this discussion. And a fellow called in, it was a call-in show, and he said, look, Smith, you know, I don't care what you say about these embryos or these cloned embryos. I've got a very disabled daughter, and I want to be able to use these nascent humans. I don't care about them. I care about my daughter. So, you know, I don't care about this morality. And I understood that because, you know, when you've got somebody who's sick and suffering, your heart breaks, and you really want to reach out and do what it takes to help them. But we cannot. Here's what happened. I said, well, let's test this. I said, if it took implanting an embryo into the womb for 2 or 3 months and then aborting to help your daughter, would that be all right? He said, yes, anything. I said, how about 8 months? He said, yes, anything. I then said, and this was kind of nasty on my part, what if there was going to be a baby born with serious disabilities? Now, Todd, we were talking about his own daughter. And he said, yes, anything, because he was so blinded by his love and his desire to help his daughter that he would put, you know, a disabled child like his daughter on the slab to be harvested. And then I said, what about somebody in a coma? He said, yes, anything. And the point of that is we can't make decisions based on that kind of understandable emotion because we can justify anything when we're in that kind of pain. But we as a society have to step back and we have to look and we have to say, what should we do? What is moral to do and what is not moral to do? And when you answer no to the question whether human life has ultimate intrinsic value simply because it's human, you can then find ways to justify exploiting those that you think are not yourself. But as in that example of that fellow who called me, he actually put his own daughter on the slab.
Wesley, with only 30 seconds and no more, can we expect big biotech to put the brakes on itself with regard to these issues?
No. Big biotech has no intention of being limited in anything. This is scientism. They think they should be able to do what they want and that they should be able to decide, the scientists and the bioethicists, what is moral in society. They won't even say no permanently to reproductive cloning. They say no for now because it's not safe. But once it's safe, and I put this in the book too, a lot of these folks are saying, well, then it's just no different than in vitro fertilization.
Wesley Smith is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia, and assisted suicide, and author of several books, including his latest, A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, thank you for being our guest.
Todd, getting 2 hours to talk about this is just a joy. Thank you very much.
Folks, you can help us defend life from beginning to end by joining the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's our monthly donor program. Simply write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Ask about becoming a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer. Issues Etc., Box 9360.